Well, for this part of the day, at least most of us know who we are. Then, that's... Last two Thursdays, I've been discussing some of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking them in groups of three. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit on steps 7, 8, and 9. But I want to precede that by first reading off to you a quote from one of our co-founders, Dr. Bob, who is not really known as well as Dr. Bill, because sadly, Dr. Bob died much earlier than Bill and was only involved in the program for about 15 years. But he was quoted as saying this, and it's important for those of you who are serious about your recovery to take heed of this quote. Because Dr. Bob said, Alcoholics Anonymous's 12 steps are a set of principles, spiritual in nature, but if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Those steps are more than something that we just hang on a wall. They're more than something we just read aloud at a meeting. I tend to sort of sometimes call them or refer to them as a code of decency. How to become, as we talked a little bit last week, a decent person. And once I accepted the principle of the first step, where I admitted that my weakness was alcohol and that I was powerless over it, my life was becoming unmanageable. The next 11 steps in that order were a set of directions. Directions on how, if I choose to change my life and to initiate some decency into it, and referred to in the book as clearing away the wreckage of the past. And that's basically what I'm going to talk about today is clearing away the wreckage of the past. But first off, Don and I was talking here this morning about how some people tend to confuse this program and try to make it a big entity, bigger than it really is, and because it's referred to as a simple program, as a simple program. And I have a little article, or not an article, a thing that my sponsor gave to me some years ago, that's going to be in our February issue of our little Hummer magazine that we go out, that goes out every 3 months. And I'd like to read it to you, because it points out really how simple you can approach this program. The article is entitled, All I Needed to Know. All I ever really needed to know, I learned in kindergarten. Most of what I really needed to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in that kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school, but there it was in the sandbox at the nursery school. For there I learned these things. I learned to share everything, to play fair, not to hit people, to put things back where I found them, clean up my own mess, and don't take things that aren't mine. I learned that you say you are sorry when you hurt somebody, and you wash your hands before you eat, that warm cookies and cold milk are really good for you. And I learned to live a balanced life. I learned sometimes and to think, and sometimes to draw, and sometimes to paint and sing and dance and play a little in every day. I learned to take a nap. And I learned that when you go out into the world, you have to watch out for traffic. It's good to hold hands and stick together and to be aware of wonder. I remembered the little seed in the plastic cup. The roots go down and the plant goes up, and nobody ever really knows why. But we are all like that. I learned that goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the plastic cup, they will all die in time, and so will we. I then remember about the book about Dick and Jane and the first words that I ever learned. The biggest word of all was look. Everything you need to know is somewhere if you look. The golden rule in love and basic sanitation I learned in kindergarten, and ecology and politics, and a sane way of life. Think of what a better world it would be if we all had cookies and milk at about 3 o'clock every afternoon and then took a nap. Or if we had a basic policy in our nation and other nations to always put things back where we found them and cleaned up our own messes. And it is still true, no matter how old you are, when you go out into the world, it's best to hold hands and stick together. Now, that was written by a guy by the name of Robert Fulghum, who was the minister emeritus of the Edmonds, Washington Unitarian Church. It's sort of simple, sort of maybe childish to some of you, but the basic message is as adult as I've ever heard any other message. A decent way of life. That's all that's contained in those simple little suggestions that, as it says, we learned way, way back there in the sandbox, you know, the sandbox. Steps 7, 8, and 9. Now it's time, if you've gone through them first 6 and have accepted the fact that you're alcoholic, you have become willing to seek out some help from a power greater than yourself, you have taken a good look at yourself and discovered the exact nature of your wrongs. Now it's ready to put all this knowledge into effect. Now you're going to have to start doing some things. Most of the stuff you've done so far, you've just heard and learned. Now, as it says in the book, it's time for action. You put these things into action. And failure to get into action is where many people stall in this recovery and eventually return to drinking or whatever the drug of their choice is. I think it was last Thursday I pointed out that if you're driving along the freeway, you know, and your car stops, you just can't sit there and figure that in time it will start again. You've got to get out in most cases, lift up the hood, and look inside to see what's wrong. And that's exactly what you and I do. The biggest lie that all alcoholics tell is usually generated by this question. Why do you drink? I don't know. And that's a lie. Everyone in this room knows exactly why he or she drank and why you continue to drink. Where many people get it a little bit mixed up is you look for one main reason for your drinking. And that's not the way to look. You see, our reasons and our excuses for drinking are very multiple. I could have 10 drinks this morning, and I assure you I'd have 10 different reasons for taking them. Let me give you a little sick example of how you can have many reasons to drink. First off, I got it. Is anybody here work for the Safeway? That's good. All right. Yeah, you have your hand up back there?
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, well, then maybe I better not talk.
I work for
18 years.
Shoot. Did you? Well, I'm only using this as an example, not as a reference. I just want to show you how your reasons for drinking can change. Let's say you live in San Francisco out in the Sunset District, out around perhaps 48th and Caravelle. And maybe it's a Sunday afternoon, you're in the fall, and you're getting ready to anticipating this. Sitting at home this afternoon watching the 49ers play. And then your wife bursts into the living room at about 10 a.m. with that wonderful news that her mother is coming over this afternoon. And this fills your heart with joy. And so to avoid any kind of a confrontation, you might say to your wife, hey, I want to watch that damn game. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to go across the street to the dunes. That's a ball. I don't even... Murphy's, the dunes still there on 40... No, not there anymore. Dick's at the beaches? Okay. It's a synagogue. Jesus, right. Well, your eyes brightened up when I said dunes, huh? You must have got a little action there or something, huh? Yeah? Well, say you're going to go over there to watch the 49ers. All right, so your reason for going into the dunes is to watch the football game. And, of course, we all got enough class in us, you know, that we know we're not going to go into a place and just take up a seat without buying a drink. So perhaps your reason for the first drink is to justify your presence sitting there watching the football game. And maybe after you have that drink, you feel pretty relaxed and you're sort of happy you got your spot and you've solved your problem with your mother-in-law and the game is about to start. So you have your second drink to sort of celebrate this great move you have just made. And then the game starts. And maybe midway through the first quarter, all of a sudden the door opens up and in comes one of them clerks from the Safeway store. Just getting off of her shift. Dressed in that puke green outfit. That there, you know? And she's been at it, you know, for 8 long, tough hours, you know. Maybe they had her marking prices on cans or working in the produce. Probably working in the produce section and it. Beet stains and shit all over that goddamn screen. And where she's kept putting that indelible pencil back behind her ear. Now she's got sideburn on one side of her face, you know. And certainly that outfit doesn't do anything to your figure, you know. It makes everybody look like they got chests like apes, you know. And their hair is up. They've got them black flat shoes on for comfort. And it's warm, and they've got their socks rolled down. Horrible. And you sit there noticing her as she plumps down at the bar, probably up at the other end from you. And you might be passing thoughts through your mind as there's a 2-minute timeout. You might be saying, Jesus Christ, what an ugly thing that is. And then you order another drink. And that's your third drink. Midway through the third drink, you look back up to the end of the bar. And you begin to think. And of course, that always gets alcoholics in trouble, thinking. And you're thinking things like, well, she'd probably look better if she had her hair fixed. Probably got nice boobs if you could see them. Probably a good figure underneath that outfit she's got on. But God, she's ugly. Then you have another drink. And you watch a little bit more of the game and the effects of the fourth or fifth drink. Start to work on you, look back up there again, and He's not really that bad at that. Got nice eyes. I bet you she is good looking when she's dressed. And then you have another drink. And it's halftime now. Give her a drink up there. She looks like she needs it. So you have one with her. And she smiles. So you go sit by her and order another drink to celebrate that. And then you got to have a little drink to get a little courage to throw the proposition at her, right? Third quarter. Doing anything after the game? You will. Let's have a drink. And you have a drink to celebrate the consent. And then the game is over and you have a drink to celebrate the victory. Then you have a drink to get in the car to go to the motel. Then you have a drink to give you courage to give a fake name at the desk in the motel. Bill Jones from Daly City. Then you have a drink when you get in the sack. A drink to make you good for all night. Then your next drink is because you wasn't good for all night. So you've had about 10 drinks. 10 different reasons. And I know that's sort of silly, but that's exactly what happens to us, you know. If I was to start drinking today, God forbid, you know. I don't really know what the reason would be, but it would be a direct result of an uncontrolled emotion. I believe that people like you and I who start to drink get emotionally out of control. We get angry, mad, celibate, or whatever the hell it is, you know. And we drink. And if I took that first drink because of an uncontrolled emotion, my second drink would be to try to cover up the guilt that I have because I took the first drink. And then the third drink I would take would be in the hopes that I wouldn't run into any of you who, so you would know I was drinking. And then the fourth drink would be for some reason like, I've sure been wasting my time in that AA. And the fifth drink would be sort of a celebration because, hell, I've had 5 drinks and nothing's happened. I haven't had a convulsion, DTs, shot a cop or anything like that, so I'll have another. And again, each drink I took would be for a different reason. And that's how we wind up in this situation. A situation that doesn't happen overnight. You and I didn't get like this overnight. What has happened to you and I has been a process. And in some cases, a horrible process. A horrible process. The things that you and I have been part of, or have done, or have let be part of our drinking careers are really not the kind of things you'd like to list on a piece of parchment and frame and hang over your fireplace. In most cases, the things that have been part of our drinking careers are things that we wish to Christ never happened. Things that we wish never happened. And it's because of a thought like that that alcoholics like you and I have sought desperately to establish something that's almost impossible. A thing called half-suicide. If there was such a thing as half-suicide, alcoholics would be the number one users of it. You see, me and you don't want to die, really, because the alcoholic has a character defect, which is not really a defect. It's a zest for living. All alcoholics love to live. We love excitement. We love action. We love life. But yet, they say that we lead the world in suicide, too. So what happens? We must want to kill that part of our life that isn't nice. That half that has all of the garbage in it. In other words, we'd like to jump off of the bridge. And before we hit the bay, all of the shit in our life would die. And before we hit the bay, we'd beam me back up, Scotty. You know, we'd come back up with just the joy and the fun in our lives. Well, that thing that I talked about here the other day called common sense tells us that you can't do that. If you could have half suicides, that would also mean you could paint a black house white with blue paint. And there's some things that you just can't do. And it's not a rule, it's not a law, it's not a commandment that you don't do this. There are just things that you cannot do. And you can't paint houses black with white paint. You can't paint them black with white paint. There's certain things you can't do. And obviously one of the things that you and I can't do is to safely predict the outcome of what's going to take place when you and I drink. And how do we know that? We know that by our own experience. The greatest teacher in the world. There's not a person in this room who's identified as an alcoholic who can get up and honestly say that they can control their drinking. You know why I can say that? Because if you could control your drinking, if you had the power to turn it on or off, you wouldn't be sitting out here right now. Because every one of you tried to stop before you came here. Every one of you passed thoughts through your mind of, I'm not going to give that fat, bald-headed son of a bitch $575. I'm going to do this by myself. And here you are. Some of you said, why do I have to go to Calistoga? I've been there before. All they're going to do, and we used to do, is give me a drink every 4 hours for 3 days and I'll be all right. Shit, I can do that here at home. And you tried to do it. And you spent the $575 trying to do it. And you lost the control. Lost the control. You can't control your drinking. That's why acceptance becomes a very important thing in our program. When you identify as an alcoholic, do you realize what you are really saying if you're truthful, if you're honest? And let's face it, if you're not going to be honest with the only person that counts, you, you're wasting your money, your time, and my time, I assure you, by being in a place like this. As a matter of fact, I'd consider you a damn fool for being in a place like this. Even go as far as calling you an idiot to be in a place like this if you still think you can drink. But when you raise your hand at the beginning of this meeting or any other meeting or vocally say, my name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic, what you are saying is, my name is Joe, and I accept the fact that I have lost the ability to control my drinking. Or I have lost the ability to control whatever the drug of your choice is. Now, if you don't mean that, then don't say it. There's no requirement at an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that you say these things. And don't be in that area of bullshitting yourself by saying things that you don't believe or you don't understand, because all of that does is magnify your illness. If you're sitting out here saying, I'm an alcoholic, but you've got a plan to drink, you're sick. Because in that identification, you have said, I can't safely predict what in the hell is going to happen when I drink again. You've seen me do it before. You and I don't drink like social drinkers anymore. The price is different. I don't know what the hell the price is for booze, but it used to be you'd go in and throw a couple of bucks down and you'd say, give me a double shot of VO and a little kicker of beer on the side. That's how normal people drink. That's how perhaps we used to drink. Now, whether you like it or not, you walk in and take a drink now, you throw it down. Give me a double VO and water. And you put down the money. You put down your job, your family, your kids, your car, your self-respect, your health, your life. And you don't know what the hell he's going to pick up. You're the one that says that, not me. That's exactly what you're saying. I've lost the ability to control, so I don't know what the hell you're going to charge me. What's that? You're going to take my wife and my job? My kids? You're taking it all? Now, can you accept that? Can you accept that in the same vein that you accept the fact that you can't paint a house white with black paint? Because that's the level of acceptance that this program demands when it says, this is a program that demands rigorous honesty. The honesty we're talking about is self-honesty. Honest with yourself. Your lies and your bullshit to each other or one another is inconsequential. It don't mean nothing. If you really want to know something, and I don't like to say this, but come on, that is fact. None of us in this room really, really is going to have a very traumatic experience if one or the other of us in this room returns to drinking. We're not really that important to each other. Basically, we're all or should be really concerned in, God help me, I don't want to drink again. I don't really give a goddamn what the hell they want to do. It's me I don't want to drink. That's how you got to feel about it. That's how you got to feel about it. Some of you say, well, I'm getting sober to save my job. Or I'm getting sober so we won't get divorced. I'm getting sober because if I don't, the kids will leave me. Let me show you something. I'll tell you something. Share something with you. Suppose, first off, we've got to realize this. What is alcohol? What are drugs to you and I? In most cases, they're pretty important in our lives. To some of us, drinking is the most important thing in our life. And as we said the other day, in time it will become the most important thing in your life. It's something we like to do. It's something that we think does a lot of things for us. It's very important. So now all of a sudden a conflict starts. The boss down there at the printing outfit that you work at comes to you and says, Joe, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to get fired. Jesus Christ. I don't want to get fired. Only got 4 more years to go to retirement. Don't know where the hell I'd get another job. Not really trained for anything. Friggin' house payments of $483. Jesus Christ. Well, I guess I have to quit drinking to save my job. So now the wheels are in motion. I have to do something that I don't want to do in order to keep my job. All of a sudden, my job becomes a cross to bear. My job is keeping me from doing something that I really want to do. My job is keeping me from being happy. My job is keeping me from having fun. My job is keeping me from being a good dancer, a good lover, a good looking, and all these things that booze does for me. I hate my job! Just as soon as you hate your job performance begins to fail. And pretty soon, even though you're sober, you're not doing the job. And that same boss comes up to you and says, hey, you're not doing the job, you're fired. And there you go. Now you can drink, right? Now you can drink. And the same holds true with the wife who threatens the husband or the husband who threatens the wife. Be careful of that. Don't be running around saying, I'm going to divorce you if you quit drinking. If you don't, because all of a sudden, Even though he or she stays sober, all of a sudden, they see you now through a different set of eyes. Now, instead of being your lover, you're the one that's denying them their fun, their good time. You're taking away one of the most important things in their life. They hate you. They hate you. It's not uncommon to see many, many people end marriages after they get sober. Sometimes I think that there are more that are ended in sobriety than there are ended in drinking. Many people come to a realization sober that this is not going to work, or that the foundation, the basic foundation of love, has dissolved or disappeared or whatever. And it's been proven over and over again that relationships don't last too long without a basis of love, without a basis of affection. You know, that old crap we used to say, for the sake of the kids. That's all bullshit, isn't it? That's all bullshit. So if the love and the caring is gone, the relationship is gone. So these are the things that have been part of our drinking career, you know. We've hurt a lot of people along the way. And we can't expect these people to forgive us just because you've come up to Calistoga for 28 days. You've had your head touched by Ball Duffy and everything's going to be great now. You welcome me home. Why should that reflect on them at all? They've heard your promises for years. They've been through this all before. They've heard you say, I'm finished drinking numerous times. And they know a lot of people that went to Calistoga and are still drinking. So there's no reason to think that they should rejoice and be throwing confetti out of the windows as you pull up the day you leave here. And they have a right to do that. They have a right to do that. And then me and you sometimes in our self-pity say, shit, I didn't bother anybody. Well, that's one of the classic quotes of the alcoholic. Leave me alone. I ain't bothering nobody. Just having a couple of drinks. But I ain't gonna have a few drinks. Get the fuck out of here. Let me tell you a little story. About 25 years ago, I was pretty active hospital institutional work at a mental hospital as an AA volunteer. A place called Elgin, Illinois. And one of the guys that I got to work with there, and I didn't know it at the time until later on, was a guy by the name of Casey Marlin. And Casey was a young, good-looking guy, nice guy. His wife was a school teacher, taught elementary English in a town called Barrington, Illinois. And Casey, he wanted to get on AA. And he went through the hospital program there, and he started going to meetings with us. He started looking for jobs, and he finally got the only jobs that were available for guys with our kind of backgrounds in those days, were selling Singer sewing machines, Electrolux vacuum cleaners, or driving a cab. That was about the choice you had, you know. Casey took a job driving the yellow cab in Chicago. He was living at the Lawson Street YMCA, and he would stay in Chicago all week long and just come home on the weekends to be with his wife, who was teaching school in Barrington, Illinois. One night, Casey got up at the meeting, and he told this story, because one of the guys at the meeting had said, I can't understand why my wife's always nagging. You know, Jesus Christ, leave me alone. I ain't bothering anybody. Just sit there, you know. Casey was the youngest governor in the history of the United States. He was the former governor of West Virginia. He was elected governor when he was 34 years old. When he was governor, some of you may not remember this, but some of us who are older will. There came a time in West Virginia, of course, you know, is in the Appalachian states. Coal mining is the principal source of income there. most people in that poverty area are strip miners, coal miners, and stuff like that. And things are pretty tough most of the time in West Virginia. And at this particular year, things got very bad in West Virginia. They had been on strike for a good portion of the year. The winter set in bad. They couldn't mine. It was no work. It was just horrible. One of the severest weather windows they ever had. People were freezing. And in those days, unemployment insurance in the state of Virginia, West Virginia, was $20 a week. That's what you got. This was shortly after World War II. And there are guys in this room, remember, the 52-20 Club. You know, you got $20 a week for 52 weeks. That was what unemployment insurance was. It wasn't like it is today, $190, $180, whatever the hell it is. So these miners and their families were living basically on $20 a week. And they weren't making it. They weren't making it. People were literally starving. I know that's hard to believe in America, but it's the truth. They were starving to death. They were freezing to death. It was a national disgrace. So the federal government and the state government of West Virginia got together. And as a temporary measure, the federal government suggested to the state of West Virginia that if you raise your unemployment insurance to a certain figure, I forget what it was, we will literally match that figure, which will double the income for these people so that they can stay alive. They can stay alive. And I believe that West Virginia went up to $28 a week, and then the federal government put in another 28, made 56. So it was a big increase. And of course it went right through the legislature just like that, you know, passed right away. And it came time for the governor's signature. And they couldn't find Casey. So they missed a day. Casey tells this. And then it was the weekend. So they missed the 2 days for the weekend. And then they found Casey on Wednesday morning, which was 5 days later, literally a week. And he was up in a place called Manistique, Michigan, playing house with a woman, high-eyed drunk. And when his aide, who was a Michigan State Trooper at that time, with a West Virginia State Trooper, found Casey, he said to Casey, "You got to come back. You got to sign this bill." You know, Casey had no knowledge of what the hell he had to sign. And you know what he said? "For Christ's sake, leave me alone. I ain't bothering nobody." Now, Casey would cry about this juncture in this talk because he had a tremendous guilt and a justifiable guilt. He'd say, "You know, I'll never know how many houses went without heat for a week. I'll never know how many kids froze during the night. I'll never know how many kids went without shoes, without milk, without a cereal. I'll never know how many people, if any, died. Just because I said, 'For Christ's sake, leave me alone. I ain't bothering anybody.'" Now that sort of sounds a little far-fetched. And maybe it is. But if you want to bring it into sort of a more individual area where me and you belong, let's take a look at that. Just who the hell do we affect? I'll tell you something I believe in very seriously. I don't want to get in an argument over this. It's only my belief. I don't really think that the true problem of alcoholism is the alcoholics. I think the real problem of alcoholism lies in the lives of the people who are affected by us alcoholics. We cause a lot of harm. We cause a lot of disruption. Let me give you some quick examples of what I'm talking about. Oh, I just thought of a good one to tell you. How many of you in here know who Arthur Haley is, the author? You read his books, Hotel, Airport, and stuff like that. Did you read the book Wheels? Anybody read that? Wheels? About the automobile industry? Well, Arthur Haley lived, you know, when he was writing that book here in St. Helena. And then he moved to Puerto Rico, I guess it is, for tax reasons or something. But he's very famous for being so detailish in his writing, you know, because he actually, you know, goes back and lives these things before he writes. He worked as an assistant manager in a hotel just so he could research hotel operations. He worked in a hospital so he could come up with that final diagnosis. And when he got to the wheels about the automobile industry, he went up there in Detroit. He worked on the assembly lines for a couple of weeks. I'm going to tell you a quick story that's in that book. In that book. And you'll remember it. He said this. That whenever he buys an automobile now, he never buys an automobile that was made on Monday or Friday. And so to ask him why, and here's why. Have any of you ever read little articles in the paper of accidents where people say, I don't know what the hell happened, I was driving down a goddamn freeway and the steering wheel came off. Or this came off, or I couldn't steer, something locked. You read about this. You want to know where it happens? This is scary as hell. And it certainly is not meant to be a derogatory remark or to put down on the industry. I'm talking about us. Because I don't think that assembly line in Detroit this morning looks any different than a lot of us out here right now. Now, I may have these figures a little bit mixed up, but I'll be pretty close. In the making of a car, there are about 100 stations on the assembly line. In other words, as the car starts, it's got to go past 100 individuals who each have a job to do, one little job. Now, when the assembly line starts, it never stops, only in an absolute emergency. They have yellow cars that look like miniature fire trucks, emergency trucks, that drive all over these floors to keep these assembly lines going, because obviously, if that assembly line stops for an hour, you got 100 guys standing around with their thumb up their ass, cars ain't going to be $12,000. They're going to be pretty expensive. So there's 100 guys working on the assembly line. Now it's Monday morning. You think it's possible that up in Detroit, the 4 or 5 guys might call in and say, I can't make it today, I got the flu? Maybe 5. So now we're missing 5 guys on the assembly line. Well, you don't think that they have substitutes for every position, do you? They don't have a backup at each spot. If they did, your car would cost twice as much as they do. But that assembly line's got to keep going. So they got to run somebody in there. And I suppose they've got some sort of a backup system to some degree. But obviously, the guy that's going to go in there isn't as good as the guy he's replacing. Maybe the guy who has called in sick, maybe his job was just tightening the bolts on the right-hand side of the head. Maybe all he had to do was, with his wrenches, was boom, boom. And that was it. And then the next block come by, boom, boom. And because he's been doing it so long, he could almost do it blindfolded. But how about the guy that takes his place today? Maybe yesterday he was taking somebody else's place where his job was putting the ignition wires on the plugs. And he's not used to this. So here comes the line through. And he's just starting out now. And the first one goes by. Oh, drops the goddamn wrench. Maybe 4 or 5 go by that he doesn't quite get done. Just 4 or 5. But if there are 5 guys doing that, that means 25 cars have gone by. 25 cars. And figuring that they make a car a minute, that's what they say, 60 an hour. You know how many cars are going to come out of Detroit today that are fucked up? And me and you are going to drive them. Me and you are going to drive them. Now, that's nothing I made up. Is that in that book?
Yes.
All right. It's common knowledge. It's common knowledge, you know. How do we affect other people? And why is it such a problem? Why do we have to make amends? Why do we have to, as the book says, clear away the wreckage of the past? What wreckage are you talking about? Let me tell you a little experience of my own when I was a kid. I don't know if my father was an alcoholic or not. That's not for me to decide. My father was a player. He loved life, and man, he drank like a fish, and he was with the guys all the time. I have an older brother, Jack, who was just here on vacation, who was a very good athlete in school. And I guess some of you other guys will know exactly what I'm talking about. When you're not the best in the family, you're going to suffer, you know. And I, through my whole life, hearing, if you were as good as your brother, if you're as good as your brother, or if you could just do half of the things your brother could do, you know, your brother broke records here, your brother did this, your brother's got that down, your brother did this. And that was always my brother, you know. Or it was always, yeah, you can do it when you're old as Jackie, when you're as old. I'm never going to be old as Jackie, what are you talking about, you know. That's what I wanted to say. Well, of course, I don't know, more to please my father, I guess. I went out for everything in the school, whether I was to do it or not, you know, I went out. But I'd done all right, you know, hey, I was no big all-American guy or anything like that, but I played on the team, I was on the team. And as a junior, I was on the varsity football team, which was a big deal in New York, you know. I'm not talking about high schools of 300 kids, I'm talking about high schools that got enrollments of 6,500 students, you know. So to be selected on a team, well, you had to have some kind of talent. And I was doing all right. But my father and a lot of other fathers, and you see it even today around Little League games and any place where kids are involved, their pattern on Saturday, these adult men used to be get drunk on Saturday morning in a neighborhood saloon and then go out to the game. You know, there wasn't night games when I was playing. The big deal was Saturday afternoon. And I don't know whether they had connections with the coach or they bought the coach's drinks or what, but I'm even guilty of this today. But they seemed to never have to sit in the stands, the fathers. They always ran up and down the sidelines, you know, close to the play. I do that now with my son Gene's son, Brad, who played, you know. But I don't do some of the things my father used to do, or other fathers. God, how I remember them. My father would be half whacked out of his mind, you know, and in front of a lot of people, in front of my classmates or girls that I was trying to impress. He'd be yelling out, "Hit him, for Christ's sake! I'm asking that son of a bitch!" Drunk in hell, you know. "What the hell are you taking my kid out for? A coat? Put him in the garden!" Oh, shit, I want to die. And I'll tell them about Bubba, I think. They'll get a kick about Bubba. And this certainly is not meant to be racist. Our big game of the year is against a high school called White Plains, New York. White Plains High School. Orange and black. Big high school. Big kids. Jesus Christ. They had a black fella played in the line, tackle. Bubba Williams. Jesus Christ. He had to be the best high school ball player I've ever seen in my life. He was a nice kid. I knew him because I belonged to the boys' club, and I used to see him during the off-season at basketball games and things like that. And everybody liked Bubba. But he was a monster of a guy. Big guy, you know. He finally went to New York University, NYU, on a scholarship. Then they de-emphasized football. But Bubba was a big guy. And we're playing White Plains, and I'm down there at about 140 pounds playing opposite this Bubba. Just a ridiculous situation. And it rained that day, and it's muddy, and it's, oh, shit, you know. So my father's running up and down the sideline, and we're lining up, and I'm right opposite Bubba. We're all covered with mud and all that. And my father hollers out, "Eugene, put that fucking nigger on his ass!" I'll never forget it. Bubba just looked at me, sort of smile, and you know, and he just, "Why don't you do what your daddy tells you?"
And about that time, he buried me in about 3 foot of mud, you know. I didn't come up till the end of the game. Jesus.
But I quit football in my junior year rather than go back there as a senior and have to go through that humiliation of my father again, you know. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to play bad. I wasn't going to go out there for 12 Saturdays in a row and have that old man of mine embarrass the shit out of me. Now, on another level, we do that, all of us who are parents. I'm going to say some things that might hurt some of you fathers. When was the last time your kid invited you to the father and son dinner at school? When's the last time, folks, that your kids brought classmates home? When's the last time they wanted you to share some of their activities? Or were they too ashamed to ask you because of the fear that you might be drunk when you show up? Did you ever have to go to a father and son dinner with somebody else's father? Because you didn't ask your father? How many kids are scared to bring somebody home because they're afraid their mother's laying there on the couch passed out? 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is how you affect other people. Other people. Let me give you another example. Leave me alone. I ain't bothering anybody. No reflection on any particular law enforcement agency, but there have been times when I've had in residence here, there are men here right now who are law enforcement people. Let's just say there were 3 cops here right now from San Francisco. Don't sound like a big deal, does it? But assembly line principal stands in there. I think the San Francisco Police Department is about 1,800 men, maybe more, I don't know, but it was at one time that I remember. You think they went out and hired 3 guys to fill in for these 28 days while these 3 jokers are up here? No. That means that police department is 3 men short, is what it means. At least 3. Plus maybe 4 or 5 that got the flu this morning. That makes 8. And maybe add 2 that had to go home at noon. So there's 10 less men there. Well, that doesn't mean much. Unless you get raped. Or your child gets molested. Or you get shot. Because the protection that was supposed to be at a certain place is not there. It's up in Calistoga. Or it's home with the flu. Very remote thoughts, but possible. All possible. How many people do we affect, and why would I say that our problem is really in the people we affect? Let's look at it this way. I've never been one that believes in any kind of statistics. But some kind of an agency someplace says that there are 10 million alcoholics in this country today. Personally, I believe there's probably 30 million. I believe there's 10 million in California. That's only my opinion. But we'll use 10. We'll use the smallest figure we can. Then there's another agency, and even AA holds this in accord, that each alcoholic directly affects the lives of at least 8 other people. At least 8. Now, that's a very small figure. How many people are being affected right now by your alcoholic problem? Let me help you along a little bit. Suppose I return to drinking today. Suppose I wound up back in a penitentiary or on Skid Row. Who would be affected by my drinking? So would my wife. So would my 3 sons. And so would my sons' wives. And so would 5 grandchildren. And so would a brother. And so would a sister-in-law. And how about the 26 people that work here with me? And how about their wives and their children and their kids? You affect a hell of a lot more than 8 people, I assure you of that. But we're going to use that. We'll use 8. 10 million people each affecting 8? We're talking about another 80 million people. We're talking about 80 million people who are suffering the effects of alcoholism, and they don't have it. That's like, you know, having somebody in your family get polio. And you have to wear the braces. Innocent people are affected by it. The alcoholic has got the easiest road in the world. He doesn't have to do the lying. His wife does the lying for him. My husband got the flu today. He doesn't have to face the creditors. He's passed out. Well, I'll do the best I can. That's what the wife's got to do, what the husband's got to do. The drunk, he's like that big, fat male lion. He just roams around looking for something to eat and drink and get laid once in a while. That's what me and you are. I don't like to say that. I'm one of you. But that's it. Leave me alone. I'm not bothering anybody. So now it's time to start paying back. If you got the guts. You got the guts. It says, became ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. You think that's all there is to it? You just say, hey, God, take all this shit out of my life? What makes you and I think that it should be that easy? How about doing something about it? Saying you're sorry, being sorry, and showing that you're sorry are three different areas. Three different areas. Lip service never got anybody any place. Lip service is the cheapest gift of all. Most of the lip service you hear is all bullshit anyhow. Gee, you look great today. You say that to everybody, don't you? Even though they look like they got hit in the mouth with a truck. My God, you look nice. Nice dress you got on. I wonder where she got that goddamn thing, you know? Oh, bullshit. I'm sorry. You know? That's what Hitler said to all the Jews. I'm sorry. What Hannibal said when he crossed the Alps. Pushed all them elephants over to say, I'm sorry, elephant. I'm sorry don't mean nothing unless you show it. So you make a list. That's what it says. We made a list of all persons we had harmed. All people you owe. That's right, owe. Not money. People you harmed. You got to change from an attitude of getting even to this. A lot of us want to get even, don't we? I'll get even with that son of a bitch. Hey, I'll tell you something. Surprise the hell out of you. If you want to feel good today, and you want to get even with somebody, get even with somebody that's done something nice for you. Do you ever think of that? How many of those get evens do you owe? Never mind somebody that screwed you. How about somebody that done something nice for you? Why don't you get even with him? Do something nice for him. Oh, no. That's too difficult. And then it says here in that ninth step, we made these direct amends. And listen careful, because this is important. To such people, whenever possible. Sometimes it's not going to be possible. Sometimes it's too late. Sometimes that father or that mother that you wanted to make them amends to passes on before you get a chance to do it. Maybe that guy you owe money dies, goes away, or you can't find him. But whenever possible, you make these amends. At least you'll be ready to make them. Except, careful now, when to do so would injure them or others. Now, don't go running over to your best friend's house tomorrow and say, I got something to tell you, I've been screwing your wife for a year. That ain't going to do you much good. And don't try to make an amend that's going to ruin somebody else's life. And don't expect to be forgiven. The scars may be too deep. The hurt may be too bad. These three steps have nothing to do with forgiveness. It's all for you to do. The decision is up to them. It's up to them. I walked into a saloon on Skid Row after I'd been sober 14 years. Didn't even get through the doorway, and the guy said to me, I told you to get out of here and stay out of here. Didn't give me a chance to say, well, hey, Christ's sake, Augie, I've been sober 14 years, long day. He didn't give a shit about that. I almost made this guy lose his goddamn business. Cost him a lot of money. And he wasn't about to forgive me with a, I'm sorry. But I did it. I had been willing to do it, so that's all right. At least I'd been willing to do it. But don't be too hard on yourself, either. And my late mother pointed that out to me very well, right here. About a year or so before she passed away, when she was 86 years old. I was going to try to make amends to my mother. I had made my last two what I thought at that time, but since then I've come up with a couple more. Or financial amends. I remembered I'd owed a dentist about $75, I thought. $175, whatever the hell it was. And I had a grocery bill in the store, over 30 years old. But I knew I owed that money, and I never paid it back. So I had sent each of these individuals. I'd finally located them. One grocer was dead, but his wife was still alive. The dentist had since been retired and out of business, but I sent them each $200 check. Because it was important for me to do it. You see, my mother said to me, what the hell are you sending them checks for? You know, they've probably written it off by now and all of that. That isn't what counts. That's what they can do. I had to do it. I had to be willing to do it. To clear my mind. And when I told my mother that, you know, it dawned on me I had never made any amends to her. And what I'm going to tell you now is sort of a cop-out, but we're great for cop-outs anyhow. And it might help you. I don't know how much I hurt my mother, really. My mother wasn't present in my drinking career because I was out of New York State and I didn't go back there so she could see it. But God Almighty, she suffered more. You know, she was the one who got all the calls. She was always the one I listed as next of kin. Highway patrol would call her. The warden of a correctional facility would call her. This is to inform you letters would arrive, you know. Your son is now incarcerated here, there, or that. Or your son has just been admitted to a state insane asylum. Your son has done that. And that's the kind of torment that I put her through. She told me once, and at first I didn't like it when she told me, but I understood later on how much love there was in it. She said there were many times, my mother was a very deeply religious lady, there's many times I made novenas at the church to pray for your recovery. She says, even once I made a novena praying for your death because I thought the only peace you'd find in life would be by dying, because she knew I was going through such hell, you know. And this little old lady said to me one day right out there in front of that stone house, after I had wanted to make all of these amends to her, all these I'm sorries, she said, sit down and shut up. She says, 'cause I want to tell you something. She says, I love you more today than I did the day you were born. And all of these things that you've gone through, all of these things that you're so sorry for, all of these things that you want to make amends to me for, were obviously necessary for you to be where you are today. And she says, and where you are today makes me proud to be your mother. And I love you more today than any other day in your life. Everything that's happened to us, I guess had to happen to bring you to where you are right now. And if your mother was sitting there with you right now, she'd be sharing a very important time in your life. A time called decision. Because it's your decision and only your decision that
It's not mine to make for you, and it's not your spouse's to make for you. It's time for you to make a decision. As it says in that book, either to continue on in my madness or to reach out for recovery. Any questions or any comments before I close this meeting?